To quote today's guest, Martin Shaw, author of Smoke Hole, "We may have to seek some solitude, but let's not isolate from the marvelous." And we can get started by giving him a listen today. I'm Robin with Tributaries. Martin, you write, "Paying attention leads to witnessing a secret history of the earth." And now I quote, "Not the only history, but one tributary of a big river that eventually leads us to the vast ocean of time and consequence." Could you elaborate and weave in what you mean by old mind, not new mind? And is this what you mean by bone memory?
Yeah, certainly, Robin. Good question. When I am talking about the old mind, it is a reference to what I call bone memory. A few years ago, I got thinking about memory because memory, as you can imagine, is a very important issue if you're a storyteller, whether you're a writer or an oral storyteller. And I realized that I had three different types of memory. I had what you could call skin memory, flesh memory, and bone memory. Now, what I mean by that is this. Skin memory is the kind of events that you would put on a CV. In 1988, I worked in a factory in the cabbage fields of Lincolnshire. In 2003, I married a woman called Vanessa. I mean, I'm just making these things up. But in other words, they're just events. Then flesh memory is different again. Flesh memory are things that have really marked you in the travails of your life. It could be an illness, it could be a depression, it could be some great opportunity. But in a way of seeing it, it's left scar tissue on you. The good, the high points as well as the low. But then there's this third kind of memory that is less rational than the other two. Bone memory. And bone memory is the thing that a decent storyteller is a custodian of. An example I often use of it is they've done experiments in laboratories with little chicks who've grown entirely in the laboratory. But when you put the shadow of a dove over the chick, they don't react. But if you put the shadow of a hawk over the chick, they become very agitated. That's bone memory.
Right.
So what I experienced years ago was I can hear stories from 3,000 to 4,000 years ago, as can anybody, and we have a response to them that is rather like that little chick. Even though we may not have ostensibly lived through the things we're hearing about in the Odyssey or Beowulf or the Descent of Inanna, somewhere down in the, it's a lovely old word, chthonic, down in the belly of us, we recognize it. So my job, really, over the last 25 years, has to do a kind of deep listening to the circumstances of my life. Often, I meet people that are actively pursuing what you could think of as a spiritual quest, and they're gobbling, you know, visionary vegetables. They're gobbling ayahuasca, or they are becoming very attracted to beautiful Eastern philosophies and religions, or something else. All of these things are tremendously powerful. But what I'm trying to get at in Smoke Hole is that actually the circumstances of your life, the family that you were born into, the town you grew up in, the decisions that you've made, all have a kind of mystic resonance to them if you can approach them with this notion of your old mind. So in other words, you don't necessarily have to keep looking for things far outside your personal experience to get an encounter with soul. Really what you want to do is look at what's just underneath your feet. So that's a little bit to respond to your question.
Yes, yes, beautifully said. And I can so relate. My mother is English, and she came over to the U.S. after experiencing all the bombing that went on in Birmingham, in England. And when I was about 8, and they did the first air raid siren in my town, I felt such fear at a cellular level, and yet my mother had never even spoken of any of that. And I didn't realize it until many years later, but that was what was going on. It was a cellular memory that my mother carried and passed on to me.
Wow.
And another thing that you just brought up in telling what you just did, one of the stories in Smoke Hole is titled Growing Your Hands Back. And you say the roots to this story are very ancient and likely not human at all. What do you mean by that?
What I mean by that is not that the story is entirely non-human, but it goes back to an old perception that I have had for a long time, and I'm sure many others, that one of the things that's interesting about myths that come from an oral tradition is that there are often scenes or encounters within the story where the intelligence of the narrative doesn't necessarily seem to be coming from a human point of view. Suddenly you're seeing the stories from the perspective of a forest that the handless maiden is moving through, or a crow that lands on her shoulders. It seems as if very ancient tales have moments in them where the earth itself is thinking through the story. So rather than just a wonderful novel that's dreamed up in the febrile imagination of a modern writer, in the old myths and oral traditions, especially in indigenous cultures, you get these moments in the story where it feels like the perspective in it is almost across species. It's not just humans talking about the difficulty of being humans in the earth. You almost feel something coming back from the earth. The reason why this is particularly interesting to me is that I've spent the last 25 years as something called the Wilderness Rites of Passage Guide, which culminates in people going out for 4 days and nights without food into a wild place, whilst I and my little team stay nearby, and they come back with stories from their encounters with the wild, with their dreams that when they were out there, with their travails and struggles, with their epiphanies, that read, as they're told, like little myths. But the wonderful thing about those stories is you hear, it's very hard to articulate, but you hear the forest speaking back to you through them. That's the kind of thing in an era of, you know, climate emergency that we're clearly in, I'm very interested. In other words, old stories could possibly have keys in how we respond and talk to, you know, the wider earth in a time of great crisis.
Yes, and as you allude to in your book, all good storytelling really petitions that we live consciously between the time-bound and the timeless. And when we're listening to the story of the forest, we're definitely moving in that direction towards soul, aren't we?
Yeah, we are. I must say that you've done a beautiful job of reading this book, because these are, they're little phrases, but you can turn them round. And one thing I say in the book is we make things holy by the kind of attention we give them. And so whether or not you live in an urban environment, William Blake, one of the great Christian mystics, an English mystic, lived in London all his life. But it didn't mean that he didn't live in a visionary awareness where he was listening the disclosures of trees and rivers and people and dreams. But we have to be, you know, fairly receptive, fairly conscious to do that. And one of the things in the book that, as you will remember, that I've been sort of growing more uneasy with is the extraordinary power of persuasion that a lot of social media has, especially with our children. Friends of mine have said recently, and I agree with them, that when we were growing up, the big event would be to go to America and go to New York and drink in the White Horse Tavern where Dylan Thomas drank in, or Jack Kerouac, or to go to Africa and to stalk with the Kalahari Bushmen. But a lot of young kids that I know and love and respect, the big event for them now is in their pocket. It's their phone. And there is more interest in technology as a frontier that they want to investigate than anything out there in the world. You know, we're in trouble ecologically, and Elon Musk is talking about going to Mars. Mars is not going to fix what's going on with the planet. The Earth is what's going to be what fixed the situation we're in, and by attending to it. So the book is, again, crying out for us to pay attention to what's right in front of us, really.
Yes, and, you know, there's something in me that has the utmost faith that we are still being led by grace, and we are still being moved by that unconscious unity, maybe for lack of some better words, perhaps. But and so just watching and observing, as you say, the consciousness that's just filtering into the device in the pocket, I can't make that out to be bad. Do you know what I mean? It's like I just have to watch it and see where it goes without labeling it one thing or another. And do I agree with you about the potency of being connected to the alive Earth? Absolutely, 1,000%. So it's a funny line that gets drawn. And I think by drawing a line, it can create, that's where the initial breakoff happens.
I think there's a sense in that, in what you're saying. I think my question is not, or my position is not that, you know, all technology is bad or should be abandoned. I don't think any of those things. I just have a very simple question in the book, which is, when does a tool become a deity?
Right.
And that is different to me. When I think, you know, technology, the thing we're using right now to have this interview, is an extraordinarily powerful piece of magic, and I'm very grateful for it.
Me too.
But like anything in life, things, you know, if we like doing something, we tend to overdo it. Quoting William Blake again, he used to say, "You don't know when you've had enough till you've had more than enough."
Right.
And I wonder, actually, I think a lot of us, having been in lockdown for a year and our eyes are exhausted from Zoom, and with a lot of us, there's a kind of inertia with this phrase brain fog.
Right.
I've been pretty much a lot of the time alone in a cottage in the wilds of the far west of Britain. And I realized a few months ago that I was withdrawing deeply into myself in a way that was not contemplative, but not useful anymore.
Right.
So one of the things that I value is having conversations with people like yourself, because I feel I'm beginning to move back out into a world that has other people in it again, rather than being in this kind of cocooned state that feels a little bit like an initiation experience, but with no guarantees of what that initiation will lead to.
Right. And it totally feeds into the smoke hole. And why don't you share what that means and what that, why don't you share what that, where that originally comes from?
Yes. One of my deep treasures over the last 20 years has been reading and investigating Siberian folk tales and stories. And one of the images you get in a Siberian story is when you want to do something wicked, you need to close the smoke hole of the tent so God can't see you do it. And the idea, because of course God is looking through the smoke holes of all the Tongass and the Evenk and the Yakut and all those wonderful tribal people, he or she or whatever it is looking down through the smoke hole, and you are in dialogue. But you close the smoke hole, you bury your heart under a tree, as it were, and suddenly you're capable of terribly damaging things, because you are no longer in the presence of the divine or the divine world. And so when we went into lockdown, I remember writing a letter that I just sort of sent it out really through a magazine called Emergence, called Keeping the Smoke Hole Open. And it was really arguing the case that we should go into this enforced lockdown and use a different word, use the word solitude. Because actually, most of us, a year ago, how many people do you know saying, you know what, I really need 6 months off. And I've been working since I was 18. Well, we got it.
Yes.
We got a journey into the deep interior. I think everyone's going to come out with different perspectives. There are certain things that bind it up, but different for most. And for me, keeping the smoke hole open was my attempt to keep conscious as I went through a period of fairly serious disarray.
Yes.
And so that was the book. And actually, Smoke Hole wrote itself very quickly.
Sometimes books can
take years and years. But actually, it was a matter of days with that. But I'm as proud of it as I am of books that have taken me literally 50 times the amount of time.
Yes, I understand that. Songwriters speak about that as well, where the song writes itself. And I actually have these two friends that have been in a band forever. They've known each other all their lives, basically. And one said they dreamt that their friend said, "Hey, I wrote this song," and told them the song. So the guy that was having the dream woke up and wrote the song. So now they have this they have a funny little quibble about who should really get the royalty for that song now.
Amazing.
Yeah. So also, as you wrote, and I can't agree more, that the soul gets sick of us acting out like kids. And it is like we are culturally in an adolescent stage. And just by what you've been speaking of, this solitude is an opportunity to come out of that. And as a culture, this is a deeply mythic ground right now, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. If you recall stories, if you were lucky to be told stories when you were a child, or the movies that we love and remember, whether it's Star Wars or Lord of the Rings, they always begin in a time of great upheaval, and when it seems the odds are stacked against us. No story begins when the stakes are rather low. They begin when they're high, because when they're high, remarkable things happen. And we are in a remarkable moment in human culture. I'm not saying it isn't dangerous. I'm not saying there's any assurance of success. One of the poets and thinkers that I love is Gary Snyder. And Gary Snyder, people would say, young ecologists, because he's, of course, been petitioning for ecology since the 50s, people would say, you know, Gary, are we going to succeed? Are we going to succeed? Are we going to save the planet? And he said, well, the planet will be fine, but we may not.
Right.
And he said, in the end, and I love this, I've never forgotten it, Gary said, it's not a matter of victory, It's a matter of style. And I just really, that really pleases me.
Bravo, the notion, yes.
Yeah, kudos. A little, that we go through this world with a little bit of panache.
Exactly.
That our life actually could have some swashbuckle to it. That's my phrase of the day.
Swashbuckle,
a little pistola, a little gravitas, a little grief, a little beauty, a little bit more than we expected. So I would like to meet the infection of COVID with an infection of beauty.
Absolutely.
I think we need to come out swinging in the most beautiful way that we can.
Yes, bravo indeed. The paths in your life, both as a mythologist and storyteller and a wilderness guide, have co-joined so perfectly. Can you give a little history of how that actually came about?
I can, and I am rather pleased at that combination, because 25 years ago, you had people that wrote beautifully about myth. You had people that wilderness writes, the passage guides, but the two hadn't yet conjoined. But the interesting thing was, when I started to go out and fast on hills and things like that when I was about 23, the only language that did the enormity of the experience any justice was the old mythic stories. Psychological language didn't do it. That reduced it and made it small in a way. But I realized every time I went out into the forest, I was walking deeper into the real mythic material of my own life. And so I decided that I was going to work towards writing a book which overtly made the connection between rites of passage and mythology. In fact, through the book, and at each important stage, there was a mythological story to underpin it. That book took 5 years to write, not 5 days, and was called A Branch from the Lightning Tree. And actually, that book came out 10 years ago next month. So that was the moment. And of course, no one was waiting for that book. I had an audience of zero. No one was waiting. I was a young father trying to earn a living, working 4 jobs. You know, I was practically saying, you know, do you want fries with your miss? You know, it was on that kind of level. I would have done any job. And then incrementally, bit by bit, I had the opportunity to write another book and then another and then another. And I think the concerns of my ideas and the things I'm doing have got gradually clearer and simpler. A lot of writers are frightened of being simple because they want to appear particularly esoteric and intelligent. But actually, it's a tremendous skill to speak clearly.
Absolutely.
It's taken me probably a million words to string one decent sentence together. So at this moment, one of the things that I do love about Smoke Hole is that if you actually met me, you'd think, oh yes, he talks like he writes. This is the same character. And one of the skills as a writer you're always looking for is to have your sentences falling in the same rhythm in which you actually speak. It's what gives it a heartbeat, really.
Right.
So anyway, to answer your question, I spent 4 years living in a tent, a black tent, on a succession of English hills, training as a wilderness guide, training as a storyteller, not training with a person as a storyteller, just learning how to do it organically. And gradually those two worlds came together in my mind and they became this book, A Branch from the Lightning Tree.
When you were asked to share stories at the beginning of COVID lockdown, your response was it was too soon. And how do you see or feel this? How do you suss out the crest of the wave?
You know, I have practice in that because of this backstory of being a wilderness rites of passage guide. So when you have had this deep experience of going out into the forest for 4 days and nights and coming back, you get an opportunity to tell me quite what went on. And I do my best to help you with that. But afterwards, there's a period of time where for 1 year, I ask you not to talk publicly about it. And when that year is done, you could offer an opinion, you could tell a few close friends, but you need that period. I have to say, it's rather like a woman being pregnant with a baby. The thing needs to incubate. It's not to be pored over or examined too quick. And what I noticed in the early days of lockdown was very well-minded, intelligent people were trying to do everything they could to claw their way out of uncertainty. But actually, uncertainty and paradox are partially the passport of our time. They're the zip code of our time. And so I was curious if I could just stay in the uncertainty. And there's a phrase I probably use in Smoke, but I talk about the goddess of limit. You know, I grew up in the 70s being told I could be anything I want. It was like that Nike advert, just do it. And myth tells us something rather different. It says, no, you can't be anything you want. There's something very specific that you were born to do that the moment you're born, you forget. And the circumstances of your life are trying to help you remember. So in other words, there's a vocational element to our lives. And when you meet people who are connected to that sense of vocation, it's as if they have an extra charge about them or an electricity.
Right.
And I'm hoping that in a weird way, something like COVID can redirect us to our personal sense of vocation, not what your parents may have wanted for you necessarily, or your family or your friends, but this strange little message you were designed to bring into your life.
Yes, absolutely. And years ago, I started feeling a similar thing about being anxious. And what it meant to me was there's a shift. There is something about that is going to change, but you are not mentally or intellectually cognizant of what that quite is yet. So you're feeling this thing in your body, but your mind hasn't quite caught up to it. So just chill out, basically, and see what comes up.
Yeah. Very good.
So I thought to ask you where the philosophy of wilderness comes into our story, but perhaps it would be more enlivening to hear your view on where that philosophy leaves us and a step or two to bring it back.
Certainly. I like, one of the joys of Smoke Hole was phrases and ideas just kind of pouring out of my pen very quickly. And this idea of a philosophy of wilderness or wildness is interesting to me. Where I hope that is leading is something that I always say. I hope it's always leading into a love affair. Because it's interesting, I'll be 50 in October. And I have had experiences, like all of us, of happiness, sadness, years where nothing so much is happening. But I've decided, whether or not it involves another person, I intend to be in a love affair for the rest of my life. I'm going to be in love now. That's what's going to happen. And it, as I said, it doesn't necessarily require a relationship with a person. It's nice if it does. But when you are listening to the strange emanations of the world. As I'm talking to you, I'm looking out of my window and there's bird song and I can feel the wind on my hand. It's an animate, sensual world that's communicating to me at this exact second. So I swoon, you know that phrase, to swoon, almost like fainting. Mm-hmm. I swoon with the delight of all this information that's coming towards me. And the thing that it does, actually, is it tenderizes my middle-aged, bitter and cynical little heart.
Mm.
And when I am tenderized, when I am in love with something, I make different decisions. I'm much more caring and attentive. I give more. One of the phrases that I came across in, or I talked about in Smoke Hole, is something I once heard someone else say. So this doesn't come from me. It comes from a man called John Lee. John Lee was saying there comes a point in any relationship where instead of loving someone in the manner you think they should be loved in, you say to them, how do you want me to love you? What's really going to work? And what I do is I take myself out to wild locations and I ask that question of the place rather than necessarily a person. How do you want me to love you? In the old Grail legend, Parsifal, there's a wounded Fisher King, and no one knows how to fix the wound. Until after all of this great questing and adventure and drama, someone, usually a knight called Parsifal, asks the Grail King a very simple question. He says, what is it that ails you, uncle? And the moment he shows that empathy, this extraordinary thing happens, and the wound begins to heal. Mm. So my feeling is any philosophy of wildness, anything, a culture of wildness, it's got to be something that has the question in it, what ails you? And as I say, an infection of beauty to respond to COVID, a re-falling in love with the world again, because it simply changes the way we behave. I think we've grievously ill-managed our behavior to the planet. And that behavior also relates to our relationship to the feminine in general. It relates to our understanding of cultures that aren't Western. It's all kind of connected, and we all kind of feel that. And the pot is definitely buzzing at this point. And what I'm just trying to do in Smoke Hole, in my own tiny way, is show people a bit of that prayer mat of mine, keep my own smoke hole open. But really, the question I suppose I'd have at the moment for other people that are moved by the book is, how did you keep your smoke hole open over the last 12 months? How have you done it? How have you found a way to stay nourished? So I think that's one of the conversations I'll be looking forward to having, as hopefully, at least in some parts of the world, we get a little bit more agency back.
Wonderful. In closing, I'd like to just ask you, Martin, this is the only book of yours that I've read, Smoke Hole. I wasn't aware of you before this. Did it just feel like you nailed it? Because I really feel like this book is such a gem, and I feel like, wow, you just totally nailed it. Is it different than the other books?
Yes, I think it is different. A dear friend of mine who rang me recently about it, and he said in the past, he said, I've always loved how you write, but because you were younger and you were working as an academic and you were proving yourself as a mythologist, there's a lot of kind of extra thinking going on. But he said, in Smoke Hole and Courting the Wild Twin, which is the book that just came before it, he says, it's just pure wisdom. There's nothing you're trying to prove other than what's just right there in front of you and seems alive in the moment. Mm-hmm. Now, that's a very kind thing for him to say, and I have no idea if it's true or not. I have no idea how wise or foolish the book may be, but I love its compactness and its smallness, and I certainly stand by it. My other books tend to be bigger and stranger and less resolved somehow. And I like all of that as well. Right. I always say that I write pastoral books and prophetic books. Pastoral books are books like Smoke Hole that I hope have some kind of use for people other than myself. And then the prophetic books are rather odd things. They're dimensions I just have to go at as an artist, but whether people will respond to them, I have no clue. But Smoke Hole, it is a kind of love letter. There is something very urgent that I'm trying to express in it. If you look at the page of who the book is written for, you'll understand, because it's written for my daughter. All dads everywhere are putty in the hands of their daughters, and I am proudly no exception. So I wrote it for the person that I love most in the world.
Just a delight. Martin Shaw, author of Smoke Hole. For anything Tributaries related, it's tributariesradio.wordpress.com. Podcasts are in the usual places. This is Robin Clare. Thanks for staying tuned.